Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America, I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome back. All right, it's going to be 60 degrees in New York City today. 65 degrees, I think they said, possibly. That's almost 70. You should have shorts on. You should have yellow shirts, baseball caps, and I want to see a lot of sunglasses today. Spring is in the air, people. Let's embrace it. But for today's show, I want to talk about something. I got an email, and this has come up often, just in conversation with various hunters, friends, guys I meet at the sporting goods store, you know, just the kind of hunting community. And it's kind of a negativity with some hunters. And the email I got was very extreme. The guy emailed me, said, "Hey, I've been listening to your show trying to pick up tips about hunting. I've been hunting for 5 years now, and I haven't seen a deer." And I was like, wow, that's hard to do. You know, a lot of people just hit them in cars and stuff. Just, you know, and my wife has seen deer walking through the woods with me just, you know, on a regular day. So, you know, my first reaction was, wow, this guy's the worst hunter ever in the history of the world. And, you know, then I started thinking about it and I was like, well, I don't know where the guy hunts. I don't know how much pressure, you know, I don't know his situation. I don't know the property. And I started thinking about it, and the guy goes on in the email and kind of explains a little bit about his predicament, I guess. And he says, you know, I watch every hunting show, and in every one of these shows, you know, he's got the Outdoor Channel, he's got the other one, whatever the other one is. And he goes, I watch hunting shows all day, and these guys are taking down monster bucks, you know, Pope and Young size deer, record breaking deer and everything. And, you know, I got a little annoyed reading the email towards the end because he's watching these shows and expecting similar results. And so I thought, well, there's my topic for this week. We're going to kind of, I don't know if we're going to say dispel the fiction of these TV shows. It's real. Those are real hunters. And for the most part, they're really good hunters. Would they have the same success I've had or others have had on public land or on smaller tracts of land, on leases that we pick up year to year? You know, the kind of, I'll call it the, you know, the regular guy struggles we have every year with our properties, you know, and that kind of thing. You know, I had Stephen Ranella in here the other day, Meat Eater TV, one of the more realistic shows, I think, you know, because he goes out, he hunts a lot of public land, he hunts a lot of state land, he goes out and actually, you know, does the scouting, does the hunt, and you could see from his show, I mean, he does 10-day hunts, he does, you know, he's on one subject, he's hunting elk out in Montana on public land for 12 days, and then at the end of, you know, four or five episodes, he bags an elk. That's the real world, you know, that's how it's done. These other shows, and again, I'm not saying anything bad, you know, I mean, it's fine. You have the opportunity to hunt. If I had the opportunity to hunt some of the properties these guys are hunting, I'd be all over it. You know, they go out, never seen, they fly in, they never see the property, they get their gear, a guide brings them to a tree stand that's already been reconned, you know, it's been scouted out, they know exactly, they've patterned the deer, and guess what happens? At 8 o'clock in the morning or at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that record setting buck walks within 25 yards of the tree stand and the guy makes an amazing shot and we have a great show to watch. Guess what, guys? If that's your experience, if that's what you're watching, that's not the real world. That's not what happens. I would say I am unsuccessful in seeing or killing deer probably 85% of the time I'm out in the woods. It's not what we do on public and even the private land I hunt, the club land I hunt. So that's today's show. I want to break all that down and kind of get real about it. When I was getting into hunting in the early, or when my father was dragging me into hunting, you know, this idea of enjoying the outdoors and being outside and the whole culture, shooting, learning archery, just woodscraft, being out in the woods, you know, in the early 80s, they didn't have the internet. You know, it wasn't like, you know the term, Google it. They didn't have that. So everything was learned from the last generation. You know, it was passed on. The techniques, everything I learned in the early years was through my father, my uncles, who we hunted with. You know, we had a club, we had a family kind of club in Sullivan County, Barryville, New York. And it was a lease, and we went every year, and that's where I learned. That's where I learned how to shoot. That's where I learned how to scout. That's where I learned how different ways to set up tree stands. I mean, you know, the club, my father and uncles, they had every type of tree stand. They were one of the first to kind of use climbing tree stands. The Baker, if you're an old timer, you remember the, or if you're not, you should know this, the old Baker tree stands were kind of the first aluminum metal climbing tree stands. And they ran right out and got them and kind of tricked them out to fit for what they needed. And they were the first ones. I thought they were crazy using these light aluminum climbers, but they did. And they also went as far as setting up. My uncle had a stand on the side of a cliff overlooking this valley. He had an old movie chair set up on the side of this cliff, probably, you know, 40 feet in the air on the side of this valley. It was a beautiful tree stand. My father put a 50-gallon drum up in a tree. They framed out a little stand for it, and they hoisted this 50-gallon drum, bolted it to the tree, and built a little table and a rifle stand inside, and that's where they hunted out of. So I saw it all, and that was great experience. And I understand some people don't have that. You know, they don't have that support group, and they really want to get into hunting, and they're kind of learning on their own. And it gets a little tougher because, you know, today the internet is a great thing, obviously. There's, you know, a glut of information out there on any topic, but especially hunting. And, you know, the range of information, you know, is amazing. You got well-established sources, you know, different magazine outlets. You have different outfitters, guide services that give information. And then on the other hand, you got some kid or person kind of, you know, sitting in their mom's basement blogging, you know, has a hunting blog. And then you got guys like me who have a podcast and you could tune in and learn a little bit about hunting. So you got to kind of discern and separate what you're watching and what you're hearing and where you're getting your information. You know, cable or satellite TV, there's multiple shows depending on where you live. You know, we have the Outdoor Channel here. I love that channel. Throw it on anytime. There's going to be some hunting or fishing related programming on. Love it. And, you know, there's at least a half a dozen channels out there dedicated to airing, you know, various hunting shows. Those are all good things. But again, you got to discern. You got to kind of look at all of these things, figure out where you're getting your information. You know, never mind when I was a kid, when an expo or one of these industry shows came around in New York State, it was a big deal. I remember my father getting all excited. Let's go pack it up. We're going to Suffren to go to the hunting show. You know, now just Google it. I mean, there's a million. There's one this weekend and guaranteed there's one in Pennsylvania. There's one in the tri-state area. You could hit within 2 hours of New York City. There's going to be a great hunting or a gun show. So those things and the speakers there are wonderful educators. You know, they're going to tell you stories. They're going to tell you tactics. They're going to tell you how they do it. And those are great great outlets for learning how to hunt too. But again, you got to filter all this. You know, don't believe this myth that exists in media, hunting media for the most part, or really all medias, right? I'm a chef. You know, I tell my students all the time, I'm like, stop being brainwashed by the Food Network. Stop it. You know, stop being brainwashed by magazines. Those are all great outlets, and I want my students to look at all of that. You know, but they see a picture of a piece of bread in Food and Wine magazine sitting on the butcher, you know, the picture sitting on the butcher block in the garden with the lilacs and the wrought iron fence in the background, and that's real for them. When we're baking something in our dirty deck oven at school, it's a different picture, and you got to be able to separate those two things. And it's the same thing for hunting. The overwhelming majority of today's experts never hunt, never set foot in what I would consider real world deer hunting settings, you know, my property. You know, there's notable exceptions. Like I said, Stephen Rinella is one. I mentioned him not just because he was on the show, but I really respect and appreciate what he does within the industry. So if you're hunting these unbelievable premium hunting properties, you're going to have more success. There's just no way around it. And I'm not damning these people. Like I said, invite me. If you're listening to my show and you got one of these properties, please invite me. I'll go hunt it, but I'll take it for what it's worth. It doesn't make me the greatest hunter on the face of the earth because I take a Pope and Young buck off a property that's been managed, landscaped, totally set up for no other purpose but to attract deer to a 25-yard circle around a tree stand. That makes life a lot easier, and it makes your chances of success in the woods a hell of a lot easier. If you break down my hunting season, you know, let's break down a typical season. I spend hunting probably, let's say, 50% of it, 60% of it hunting large tracts of land out on Long Island, archery hunting in a club setting. You know, we have a club. So we have private leases on these properties, but there's a lot of guys in my club. You know, probably the other 50% or so is spent upstate on a smaller tract of land that I lease, with a friend of mine, and we're the only two hunters on that property. And when you look at the results of those two properties, and I know there's a lot of variables. These properties are, I don't know, 250 miles apart. The deer population on Long Island is a lot larger than the deer population in the property I hunt upstate. But the bottom line is these properties are not totally managed for deer hunting. I manage my little area around my tree stand, and we have food plots, but we're talking about a collective in my club of about 1,200 acres of leased properties. Not all continuous, they're broken up. And we have food plots on one of our larger areas that's set up for birds. It's a bird sanctuary. It also attracts deer. They've set up some water sources on this larger track. And I don't use it at all because when you go to that area, of our property, the first time when I joined the club years ago, I walked over and said, wow, look at this. Look at this field, the soybean field or whatever it was at the time. I said, this is going to be a dream come true. And I started looking around the field, and about every, I don't know, 20 trees or so, probably about every 50 yards around this giant food plot, all I saw was tree stands ringing the field, you know. And then when I walked into the woods, I said, all right, you know what? I'm going to be smart. I'm going to find where the deer come in, what their access into the fields, catch them before they even get there. And, you know, believe it or not, people got smarter before me, and I started seeing more and more tree stands. And right then and there, I decided, you know what? I'm separating myself from them. Not that they're bad guys, and they're following the club rules. Tree stands are set a certain amount apart, everything else. This change, just the sheer volume of hunting going on around that field, is going to change their patterns. It's going to spook the deer. It's going to move them in different directions. And really, that's what I've always tried to do. I've always tried to kind of use all of the advantages given to me on a certain property, land, terrain, you know, deer migration, how they move, how are they going to move, how are the deer going to move on a certain property, where's the food source, where's their bedding areas, how are they getting to the two areas. You could scout around all day and find deer poop. It doesn't mean you should set up a tree stand there. You know, you got to find their patterns. You got to pattern these deer. And it takes a lot of work. Every one of my tree stands have, I spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours just scouting those locations. I sit and I watch. I sit in the trees. I set up cameras. I try to pattern deer. And that's when I'm in the woods. When I'm not in the woods, I'm looking at aerial pictures every year on Google of my properties, the big picture. Where are the houses? Where are the roads? Where's the railroad tracks? Where are these deer? Where are the thin areas in the woods? Where are these? Where's the thick areas? Where's the areas I can't access? That's where the deer bed. And I put a lot of work into it. To be relatively, I would call myself relatively successful. Every year I kept venison in the freezer in some ways. You know, meaning does, bucks, you know, I would probably say my average has been 2 deer a year. And that's pretty successful for a regular guy hunting regular properties. So when we come back from the break, I want to break this down with a little more detail and show you the differences and kind of point out the differences between these premium hunting lands that you're watching these guys use on TV and what you're probably hunting out in Pennsylvania or what you're probably hunting in upstate New York. So with that, let's take a short break here, and we'll be right back with the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
All right, welcome back. I'm Chad Pagano. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. All right, I should have went over this with my producer. Right now, we need like dream sequence music. And this smoke pouring in. I want to you know, set the stage for this dreamlike setting I'm about to describe. Close enough, Jack. On short notice, you're a genius, man. Thank you. All right, so, and I'm going to lower my voice for a second. On this large, beautiful piece of property that I hunt, we'll say it's my club, I have, I've consistently had, you know, Pope and Young bucks running around, you know, and there's one of them for every, you know, let's say 50 acres of property. There's a Pope and Young, there's a record-setting buck, one of them on every one of those, you know, 50-acre areas. What do I mean? You know, so a 2,000-acre property that these guys, you know, typically a guide would have access to, you know, these private properties, 2,000-acre property. That's anywhere 65%. I'm doing some math. Minus, that means you have a lot of record-setting deer on the property running around. you know, just having access to that much property. Add on top of that, that I can manipulate the habitat. You know, I can make the deer easier to hunt on that property. That includes food plots. Where am I putting these beautiful food plots, multiple food plots around this 2,000-acre property? I actually plant deer cover. I put in places that are just manufactured to hold deer. Deer want to live and bed in these homemade bedding areas that I have the money, the time to, and the time to create. Then I also have the time to create funnels that the deer will use to get from the bedding area to the food plot, meaning I clear it out. I cut down trees. I might go as far as bulldozing and planting grass or something that's going to make it easier for those deer to kind of move through my property. And along the way, it's going to be a killing field. That's where I'm setting up my tree stands along the way. Hunting pressure, you know, if you're hunting state land, there's thousands, literally thousands of people tromping around on state land. So hunting pressure is also controlled in my dream sequence. So that, you know, let's say one season, if I could, during one hunting season, no more than 10 guys ever step foot on the grounds of my property. And I control every step they take. I bring them right to the tree stand. I put them in the tree stand. And within those 10 guys, there's never more than three at a time on the property actually hunting during the season. The end result of this dream, when I wake up in the morning and I'm trying to remember it, is just stupid, easy, dumb deer that I could kill at will. It's a slam dunk, perfect stand locations. Basically, I am harvesting deer at will in these situations. Truthfully, in my dream, I could close my eyes, randomly point to a spot on the property and tell you if there's going to be deer there or not during a certain time of year. That's the type of properties these people, today's experts, these great hunters, these famous hunters, are exclusively hunting. You know, maybe they're not that great, but they're pretty great compared to what you're hunting and what I'm hunting. On top of that, only a small percentage of these experts are ever scouting or hanging their own stands. They hunt. Instead, they're going to a guide to hunt. The guide hunt, you know, the guide does all the work for them and puts the tree stand up, brings them to the tree, you know, basically ensuring success. A lot of these guides, if you're not successful, are going to bring you back the next year for free. And let me tell you something. When the TV host calls the guide and says, hey, we want to come out and hunt your property, he's going the extra mile because he knows it's going to be on TV and he's going to be filmed. For me, it's really, really easy to come to these, what am I going to call them, faulty conclusions on how deer in the real world will react when you're only basing that on these TV shows. You know, if you're hunting Utopia, the deer behave differently. Hunting pressure alone has like a huge impact on deer behavior, and even more on mature bucks. When hunting deer that are essentially not even hunted by normal standards, many things work that would kind of explode in your face on a normal hunting property, you know. So, you know, calling comes to mind. The result is it's real easy to get tricked into believing that a hunting technique or a product, you know, something you see on TV is so much more effective than it really is. You know, the example would be, you know, fishing in a swimming pool just stocked with hundreds of starving trout. And you use a lure that, you know, is a stick with a hook attached to it. And you catch trout. And you're now you believe you just found the new can't miss secret law of the secret fishing law that's going to make you successful the rest of your life. But you go to a real trout stream in the middle of the nowhere, and you're more likely, you know, to starve to death before you ever catch a trout with that stick, right? That's the comparison. It's exaggerated, but that's it. You can't get down on yourself because you're not hunting utopia at the end of the day. So the reason I want to bring this up is I believe that kind of this knowledge is critical. It's a critical part of making, you know, your sound decisions for determining, first of all, whether you should buy new products. You know, this guy mentioned the email. He bought everything. He spent thousands of dollars on stuff. You know, the new can't miss product. Or should you invest in precious hunting days? And what tactics should you use? You know, I would say instead of spending $1,000 on gear, take a couple of days off from work, you know, make a little less money, save the money you spent on junk, and get out in the woods and scout. You know, and besides hunting days and money, unfortunately, the main thing here is that when you buy that, There's kind of a psychology. You know, you saw on the show the guy was using a certain deer call, and you know, they use terms like guaranteed and can't miss and definitely. Yeah, we're in their environment, absolutely. And then you think, okay, I got it now. I bought this thing. I'm getting out there, and it doesn't work. Or even worse, you spook a deer, or you have a chance at a deer, and it blows it. Now your self-confidence is shot. And let's be honest, hunters, don't lie. I'm the most confident guy on the face of this earth. I'm sitting here right now imagining I look like Brad Pitt. I'm handsome. I'm tall. I'm funny. I'm very confident. But when I miss that shot or when I blow the hunt, I want to hang it all up for a couple of hours. I'm like, wow, this is the worst. I'm the worst. I'm hurting these deer. I shouldn't even be out here. You know, the example is this past summer, a friend of mine, he really, this guy, he's an older guy, and he played a huge role in getting me into bow hunting when I wanted to get into, I was a rifle hunter, muzzleloader forever, and I wanted to get into bow hunting. And he described a scenario he had encountered the year before, and he had a 140-inch buck cruising through and his property. And it was like a 40-acre, 35-acre property this guy had. He had leased out. And this deer cruised by, record-setting deer in New York State, just out of range, and cruised right by him. And he never saw this deer again. And he pondered, and he thought about this, and he was trying to think what he did to mess it up. Because everything he'd read and everything he'd seen on TV told him that there were magic tricks that he could have used that would have drawn this deer in, that would have resulted in him killing this magical buck that he saw somehow. And knowing the level of work he's invested into his, you know, time into his hunting, he was broken up about it. He really couldn't get past it. And as a young hunter, I kind of saw it more clearly. And I explained, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. What are you talking about? You're a good hunter. You know, he'd attempted to call in the buck. The buck was, you know, 40 yards out or 30 yards out, and he was grunting, and he used some doe bleats, and he snort wheezed. I mean, he used every trick in the book. And then, you know, once it became apparent to him that the bruiser wasn't going to come in, he did exactly what I would have done in that situation. You know, you do your best in that situation. Instead of expressing frustration that he probably couldn't have done anything to turn that deer towards him, you know, and get the tag on that deer. I was genuinely surprised when he showed relief in my comments. You know, he kind of said, "Yeah, you think?" And I saw this weight lifted off his shoulders. He'd been force fed for so long that there's always a solution to these deer. He'd convinced himself that he was somehow an inadequate hunter at that point. And we've all put ourselves in those situations. He was so relieved to hear from another hunter that that he'd done everything right, that it just didn't work out. That deer wasn't coming near him for whatever reason. And that's the big thing for me, the psychology of it. You got to get past yourself. A couple of years ago, I had a bad season. I hit a deer. I had taken a bad shot. I had sat there, watched this deer, and it wasn't a great deer. It was actually a four corn, possibly a six, I think. But a small young six, and I was debating shooting it. It was early season, and the whole thing, you play the whole mind game. Oh, should I shoot it? It's early. Should I use the tag on this deer? And then I'm like, who are you, a trophy hunter now all of a sudden? That's a nice buck. He's within range, and he's quartering towards a little bit, but he's so close. You play these mind games. If you're a hunter, you know what I'm talking about. And I took the shot. Ultimately, I said, you don't want to put meat in the freezer. I took the shot, and it was a bad shot. And I thought, okay, I hit him a little back, but it'll be all right. And waited, couldn't find it. Long story short, it tormented me that I ultimately made the wrong decision, took this shot, could not find the deer that we found about 4 months later, laying in a heap, rotted away with my arrow stuck in its gut. And I was going to quit. And I called a buddy of mine, and I was telling him the story, and I was whining and, archery hunting and the poor animal and the whole thing. And he basically told me, stop it. Stop it. Any archery hunter that says he hasn't missed or taken a bad shot or lost a deer along the way is lying to you. And it's all part of the psychology, and you got to embrace it, and you got to make sure that you're analyzing every situation in a logical way. You're not hunting utopia. You're not going to see those Pope and Young bucks every day on your property. And the few stories that you hear on the public lands where the guy, those are the few and far. Maybe it'll be you one day. Maybe it won't. That out of 1,000 hunters, you're going to get one of those stories where, I clamped into the woods. I dropped my tree stand. I made a metal noise. I got up in a tree, and then within 10 minutes, there was a record-setting buck standing under me, and I killed him. It's probably not going to happen to you. For as much great info as there is out there these days, there's also, I would say, record levels of misinformation or confusing information. All sorts of people are competing for your dollar, for your money, and to increase their own value, right, by convincing you that they truly are experts, that we are the best hunters in the world, and that they have uncovered the secret to hunting, the age-old art of hunting. They've just figured it out. The buried secrets are there, and they have them, and they're going to tell you. And understanding how and why that is occurring is an important step in being able to separate fact from fiction as far as how, what your technique's going to be or what equipment you need. Apply common sense. If it doesn't make sense to you, odds are it isn't true. Add in those key words, guaranteed, never fail. The words. When all else fails, just be in the woods a lot. That's what matters. And remember, like my father told me this once, and it stuck with me forever. And he said, if you have to jump up and down, waving your arms, acting like a fool, and screaming, hey, look at me, this is who I am, that really isn't who you are, at the end of the day. And you wouldn't have to spend so much time and energy convincing others that's who you are. So that's the thing. You look at these shows and the advertising and the products, stop it. Good quality firearms, and it's going to take time, and you're going to have to put in effort into learning about hunting. What I would suggest, you got to find a circle that you trust, people that you know that have had success, and pick their brains. Everyone's willing to share, and stop setting unrealistic goals. You're not going to get that record buck. Shoot a doe. Get a doe. Get some freezer. Have a venison burger and relax and just enjoy it. And the last thing I'll say on this, just remember the small things. It's not about killing when you're out there. It's about being in nature and seeing and experiencing and the whole process from hanging the tree stand, the scouting, to playing the game. It's not about winning the game at the end. When it happens, it'll happen naturally because you've become a better hunter and you've put in the time. Watch these shows with a grain of salt. All right. That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank my man Jack for engineering and producing today's shows. You could listen to archived episodes of The Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. And remember, if you kill it, you better eat it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.